Tonight's reading is from Hebrews chapter 4, and that can be found on page 1203 in the Church Bibles. Page 1203, it's Hebrews chapter 4, starting to read at verse 1. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them, because those who heard did not combine it with faith. Now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God has said, "So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest." And yet his work has been finished since the creation of the world. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, "And on the seventh day God rested from all his work." And again in the passage above he says, "They shall never enter my rest." It still remains that some will enter that rest, and those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in because of their disobedience. Therefore, God again set a certain day, calling it today, when a long time later he spoke through David, as was said before, "Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us, therefore, make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience.
Chris, thank you very much. Well, now this week we're looking at part two of a talk that we started last week. We're in a series in Genesis 1 and 2, and we've reached chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. So if you turn back to page 4 of the Bible, that would be a great help. And as you're doing that, let me encourage you to try and come, if you can, regularly on a Sunday night. We'll never be shaped and ruled by God's word if we only pick it up in sound bites. So if you possibly can come regularly and follow through what we're teaching, or at least get the tapes when you miss out, that's a great help for everybody. Last week we looked at our place in God's world, and this week we're going to look at God's purpose for his world. And my aim this evening is that all of us leave knowing what God's purpose is for his world, so that we can bring every area of our lives into line with that purpose. And at the start, I want to acknowledge right away that this claim of purpose runs at loggerhead with the prevailing philosophy of our age. The Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod, or as the man on Amazon Online called him, Jakes Monod, must have been Welsh, I think, probably, writing in the 70s in his highly influential book, Chance and Necessity, he says at the end, "Man knows at last that he is alone in the universe's unfeeling immensity, out of which he emerged only by chance. His destiny is nowhere spelled out, nor is his duty." And then earlier on, he says, "Man must at last wake out of his total solitude, his fundamental isolation, to see his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. Now does he realize at last that like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world that is deaf to his music, indifferent to his hopes and his suffering and his crimes." Now, you see, if Monod's logic is right, and that we are just a project, a result of chance, of what Richard Dawkins calls an accidental geographical separation in the rivers of DNA, if that is right, that you are basically an accident, then the ultimate position of the logical ultimate position is, as a guy called Francis Bacon said, that man is completely futile, a completely futile being. And we have to play out the game of life without reason. Do you see why I say that tonight's issue is so important? What is the ultimate purpose in life? What's it all for? Is there a point to history? I wonder if you've ever thought about it. You know, it's easy, I think, to bumble along from one fixed point in life to the next, A-levels, degrees, jobs, middle age, retirement, without really thinking about what is the point of it all. And is the prevailing philosophy of our culture that we're basically just an accident and our number has come up in the Monte Carlo game, as Mono says? Is that right? See, if tonight we can understand God's purpose for his world and begin to line up our lives with his purposes, then we have a chance to live a purposeful and a meaningful life in his world. But if with Mono and Dawkins and the rest you believe that you are just an accident, that there's no ultimate point or purpose, then you need to accept the logical conclusion that you are a completely futile being. Or as Dawkins says, I quoted the other week, all there is DNA, and DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Well, I've just got 2 points as we look at God's purpose for our world. 2 steps, if you like, to a final point. First, God's purpose for God's world gives us purpose within this world. And secondly, God's purpose for God's world gives us purpose beyond this world. And just like last week, we're going to find that it all focuses up in Jesus Christ. First then, God's purpose for God's world gives us purpose within this world. Let's have a look at chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. And chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 serves as the conclusion of the opening section of Genesis. So the opening section of the Bible runs from 1:1 through to 2:3. And 2:3 is the conclusion of that opening section. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day God had finished the work he'd been doing. So on the seventh day he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Well, now this opening section is pulsating with purpose. I hope you've noticed it as we've been through the 6 days in the previous couple of weeks. 2 blocks of 3 days showing that God made the framework of creation in the first 3 days and then filled it. The whole account heads to a carefully crafted literary pinnacle, as we saw last week in the creation of humanity. Every aspect of creation is gearing towards this pinnacle. And right the way through the first 6 days, God is reminding us, the reader, through his word, that what he has made is good. So we've seen the repeated, God saw that it was good, God saw that it was good, God saw that it was good. Good for what? Why is it good? What makes it good? Well, it's good for God's purpose. Everything is made to order. Nothing is left to chance in those first 6 days. Everything is designed according to his specification as he wishes. So there is purpose within those first 6 days. But it would be a big mistake, and it would miss the author's point, if we were just to leave it there. For the introductory section does not end at the end of chapter 1. It runs on into chapter 2, and the chapter division is extremely unhelpful, because day 7 is obviously part of the first 6 days, isn't it? You know, you don't need the brains of a nuclear physicist to work that out. 7 follows 6. So the chapter division, even one of our PhD students over there has seen that, which is helpful. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 is obviously part of the first 6 days, the seventh day, isn't it? So there are 2 blocks of 3 days carefully matching one another, and then a seventh day that stands outside of the structure of the first 6 days, and yet is part of it. And it would obviously therefore be wrong to seek to understand the opening section without looking carefully at the seventh day, because our author has carefully grafted his material together so that we see the 6 days in the light of the seventh, which stands outside and yet is part of it. Notice first that this day is a day of perfection. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but apparently number 7 symbolizes perfection in the Hebrew language. And the seventh day is mentioned 3 times in our verse. Do you see verse 2? By the seventh day God had finished. So on the seventh day he rested. God blessed the seventh day. And apparently each time it comes in a sentence of 7 Hebrew words. So it's the seventh day. The seventh day is mentioned three times, and each time it's part of a sentence of seven words. Now, if seven is a number of perfection, I think the author has got something to say to us. Again, it's quite easy to work out. It is a statement of perfection. Notice, too, that the seventh day does not end. Have you ever spotted that before? Just turn back to chapter 1, verse 4. There was evening and morning the first day. Chapter 1, verse 8, there was evening and morning the second day. Chapter 1, verse 13, there was evening and morning the third day. Verse 19, evening and morning. And yet when we come to the seventh day, there is no evening and morning. Notice, you see, that this seventh day appears to go on forever. It differs from all the others. Then notice the word rest. It is the word from which the word Sabbath comes in Hebrew. But it doesn't mean and can't mean straight inactivity. It can't do that, for God continues to sustain his creation. That's Jesus' point in John 5. Those of you who studied John's Gospel, when he says, "My Father is always working to this day." He is at work to this very day on the Sabbath. So the point is that God goes on sustaining, Jesus' point there is that God goes on sustaining his creation. So God's rest here is a rest of achievement, not of inactivity. And the point is obvious, isn't it? God achieved what he set out to do. He did his creating and he achieved it perfectly. Then notice too that he blessed the seventh day and he set it apart as holy for his creatures to enjoy. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work, and God blessed the seventh day and set it apart. And then we go straight on into the first major section of Genesis, and we find chapter 2, straight into the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve are enjoying God's creation with him in perfection. And I guess that's probably why the chapter division was put where it was, because chapter 2, with Adam and Eve in God's perfect garden, enjoying his garden paradise, with everything working as it should, is a description of God's perfect rest. Here's the point then. What God set out to achieve in days 1 to 6, he achieved. It was very good. In fact, it was perfect. And so God ceased from his creative activity in order to enjoy his perfect garden paradise with his creatures forever. No morning and evening. Now, straight away, before we go on and develop, I want us just to stop on what I'm going to call step one, that there is purpose within creation, and see that this truth should have a major impact on the way we understand the first 6 days. The seventh day stands outside the structure in order for us to see that it governs the whole lot. It is not that God was worn out by what he had done and needed a bit of a breather before he started up again. No, God doesn't seem to work on a seven-day cycle. There is no eighth day, is there? What God started, he finished, and it seems it was now time for him to enjoy his perfect garden paradise with his people. Now, of course, the seventh day sets up a creation pattern of a seven-day week that we find extraordinarily valuable and useful. The Old Testament picks it up like that. One day in seven is set apart. 1 year in seven is set apart. But the theological point and purpose of that pattern is for the Old Testament believer to write into the very rhythm of his or her existence that there is more to life than work. And that the ultimate end of God's creation is to enjoy God's rest. Do you see, this is what this seventh day is saying to us. Yes, there's all that stuff in days 1 to 6. You can pick out all sorts of themes. The environment, relationship, self-image, work. But there's more to life than those things. Listen to another fine Frenchman, Henri Blocher. We've had him before. If you haven't got this very, very useful book on these first three chapters of Genesis, you might like to take it. It answers a lot of the questions that we haven't had time for. In the beginning is what it's called. We won't chance the French. It's translated, actually, into English. Here he is. The seventh day relativizes the work of mankind. It protects mankind from total absorption by the task of subduing the earth. It anticipates the distortion which makes work the sum and purpose of human life. And it informs mankind that he will not fulfill his humanity in his relation to the world which he is transforming, but only when he raises his eyes above. The essence of mankind is not work. Now I want to just pause for a moment and apply in this just this one area that Blocher mentions, the area of work. As I say, we could take any number of areas. We could talk about the environment or relationships, self-image and so on. Did you know that your purpose ultimately is not to work? Now, of course, there is a purpose for work in creation. We are given responsibility for God's world. We are to rule over it and subdue it. As I said last week, work is good. It comes before sin and before the fall. We are not to be ascetics who claim that work is somehow unspiritual. But here in Genesis 1 and 2, we find that we would be foolish to try and find our ultimate fulfillment or self-worth in our work. Because day 7 governs those 6 days and everything within it. God's ultimate purpose is that we enjoy his creation in relation with him. So hold tight for a second. I'm going to say something very wild. There is more to life than being a doctor. There is more to life than being a lawyer, or a surveyor, or a teacher, or a nurse. There is more to life than passing your accountancy exams. A lot more. Now, we have a giggle at the expense of the accountants because it's so easy, but I want us to pause on this for just a moment and see what this seventh day does to us as we look back on everything that's inside the first six, because I guess the majority of people at St. Helens on a Sunday night come from the kind of background where people have been programmed from the age of probably about 3 to measure ourselves by what we do. If you come from a non-Christian home or even some Christian homes, you have lived under this dominant philosophy that you are what you do. So from the age of 3, numbers of children are sent to carefully chosen schools. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But for numbers, the underlying aim and assumption of doing those tests at the age of 3 and of the parents being interviewed to see if they're suitable is so that they can get to the next school and then the next school so that they can be at the right school to do their GCSEs and get the right results to do their A-levels and the right results to go to the right university so that they can be at the right place to do the right summer placement until eventually you get to the right job. Others will know that our parents moved home to get us into the right catchment area. Now, I'm nothing wrong with that. It's a great thing. It's a laudable thing to want the best for your kids. But if the end of the day it is so that they can get that prize job, so that they have the right place and an elitist view of work and so on, then we have completely missed the point. Others of us here will have felt the enormous pressure of parental expectation, weight of responsibility that comes from having parents or teachers or whatever who expect us to end up in a certain profession. Many of us this evening, I guess, have bought into the modern elitist idolatry that we are what we do, or we are worth what we are paid. Please don't mishear me. If you're sitting exams tomorrow, I am not saying that your exams are unimportant. Yes, they're important. I can see some parents of teenage children sitting here. Yeah, the exams are important. But day 7 governs day 1 to 6. God's purpose for your kids is that they live in right relation with him, not that they are a top accountant or a chartered surveyor. You see, I don't think God is primarily concerned about what job you do at all. Not primarily. Day 7 seems to suggest he's much more concerned that you live in right relation with him. So whether you're a plumber or a politician, a hard slog, high bill, heart attack, commercial lawyer or you work for the London Underground, whether you wear a suit or a sweatshirt to work, I don't think it matters terribly to God. Day seven is what matters. That what you do when you're at work is governed by a right relationship with Him. Well, now let's move on, having put that first building block into place, to the second point that I think our passage makes for us, and that is to see that God has a purpose beyond this creation, a purpose within this creation. Work is good, don't misunderstand me. Yeah, work is good. Do get the tape that we had on work on Monday night. You might find that helpful. Work is good, but it's not the ultimate. You won't find your self-worth in your job. And if you came to the city of London thinking you would find fulfillment in the job that you came to do, I suspect you're very disillusioned already. You have if you've been here for more than a couple of weeks anyway. Now the second point, God has a purpose beyond this creation. For Genesis 1 to 3 inevitably points us forward to see how the rest of the Bible handles this idea of God's rest. I said this last week, it's so important that I'm going to say it again. We must not develop our theology of the issues raised in Genesis 1 out of Genesis 1 alone. All of us will have come across various Christian groups who do that, wanting to develop the theology of work out of Genesis 1 alone, wanting to develop the theology of the environment out of Genesis 1 alone, and so on, and ignoring what the rest of the Bible has to say. Don't get me wrong, we must start there in Genesis 1. We need to see that God has a purpose and that His purpose is for creation to enjoy His rest. But if we leave it there and develop our theology straight out of Genesis 1 without looking at what the rest of the Bible has got to say, we will get it not just, we won't just be imbalanced, we will be wrong. Wrong. Of course we'll be wrong, because we've failed to take into account what the remaining 65 books, 48 chapters and 22 verses of God's book, the Bible, has got to say. You see, simply to take Genesis 1 and to develop our theology of creation and work and so on out of Genesis 1 would be like taking this fine novel by Jack Higgins called On Dangerous Ground, taking the prologue and ditching the rest of the book. We'll put it down there. You're not to read it, Nigel, during the talk. Reading the first eight pages, and then saying, well, now developing the rest of it, you'll get it completely wrong. Of course you will. In fact, you'll probably get it a lot better than Jack Higgins does. But we won't push that one, because obviously with the Bible, when you get the Bible wrong, it's really very serious indeed. Well, let's do that. We're going to go on a very fast tour. We're going to have 5 cross-references, and we've just got 5 minutes or so to do that in. Following the fall, Adam and Eve are thrown out from God's rest. They forfeit His rest on account of their rebellion. And from then on, the remaining 65 books and 48, or is it 47 chapters of the Bible, point us forward to look for the restoration of God's rest. They show us that God's purpose beyond this creation is to bring His people back to His perfect rest, both within and beyond. And I want you to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 8 to 10 on page 191. God's purpose is to bring His people back to His perfect rest. He has a purpose beyond this creation. Deuteronomy 12, 8 to 10, page 191. And here you'll find that the idea of God's plan and purpose is couched in terms of inheritance and rest and is tied to the land, the physical place of Israel, Palestine, Israel. You are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit, since you have not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance the Lord your God has given you. But you will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and He will give you rest from all your enemies around you so that you will live in safety. And you see this idea of the land, and if you look across the page in chapter 11, verse 9 and 11 and 12, you will see that the description of this place of rest and inheritance towards which God is taking his people in the Old Testament is couched in terms of Genesis 3. So verse 9, you will live long in the land that the Lord swore to your forefathers to give to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 11, the land you are crossing the Jordan to take possession of is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It's a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end. You see the idea of perfection? The place of God's perfect garden paradise? Psalm 95 picks up the idea, don't bother turning to it, and calls this land the place of God's rest. And in the Old Testament, God's people, all the way through the Old Testament, are marked out as the people who belong to the God of rest. And they're marked out as the people who belong to the God of rest by one of the things is that they are people of the Sabbath rest of God. And the purpose of the Sabbath rest in the Old Testament is spelled out a couple of times. Both times I want to suggest to you that it's basically the same. That might be quite a surprise to you. Just turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5 verse 12. Observe the Sabbath, verse 12. Look down to verse 15. Why are they to observe it? Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. So they are to remember the Sabbath, rest, because they are a people who have been brought out of Egypt. They are people who belong to the God who has redeemed them, brought them out of Egypt, to be people of the Sabbath rest. Turn to Exodus chapter 20. We're doing well. Chapter 20, verse 11. Here's the earlier command. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, verse 8. Verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Now in Exodus you see God's people are to rest as they remember that God in creation rested in his perfect garden paradise. They are God's people. They are a people belonging to the God of rest. In Deuteronomy God's people are to rest because God has rescued them out of Egypt and is taking them to his place of rest. Both are the same idea really. They've come from rest and they're going to rest. His perfect garden paradise. Now take a huge leap forward to Matthew. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. And we're going to Matthew. We haven't got time to go through the rest of the Old Testament and to show how God's people never managed to achieve the promised place of rest in the land that God promised. Suffice it to say that they were there for a short time, they disobeyed God, and so like Adam and Eve, they were thrown out of the land of rest. But in Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath rest of God, everything that the Sabbath rest points to in the Old Testament, points forward to in terms of God's people living in his perfect paradise, finds its fulfillment. So that now spiritually, and then in his new creation physically, in Christ, we enter God's perfect rest. He is Lord of the Sabbath. That's how he describes himself. Lord of everything God points to in the Old Testament, finding its focus in Jesus. Matthew 11, 28. So Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, we haven't got time to go into all this. If you're here for the very first time this evening, may I encourage you to follow this up, to look into the person of Jesus Christ. Suffice it to say that through his death, he enables his people to enter the Sabbath rest of God. Now, spiritually, in perfect relationship with God, then physically, at his rest in the new creation. And just one last cross-reference, page 1203, as we finish our rapid whistle-stop tour. 1:2-3, Hebrews 4. And the argument of this passage that we had read earlier, summed up in verse 9, there remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. So now that is the background work. What is God's purpose? What is God's purpose for his world? Well, his purpose is to bring his people to his perfect rest. Now spiritually, as we come to Jesus Christ and start to live out our lives under his perfect rule, then, finally and fully in heaven, in his place of perfect rest, Eden restored, if you like. Eden better, because there will be no chance of failure and being cast out, in perfect relationship with God forever. So do you see that God's ultimate purpose is not to be found within this creation? It is in as much as we come to Jesus Christ. But his ultimate purpose is to bring his people in Jesus to his perfect rest in heaven. People from every nation, every race, every culture. That is the message of Genesis 1 and 2. Now let's go back and apply it, shall we? And I thought we'd take it back through the grid of work, because that's where we started. Genesis 2 says we will never find our fulfillment in work in this world. Yes, there's a purpose. Within work, it's good to work. It's good to do a job well. Work is a great and good gift from God. There is a purpose, however, that stands over above our work, that should govern every aspect of our work and every aspect of our life in general if we belong to God. God's purpose is that we and all his people should enjoy his perfect rest with him, now spiritually, then forever, in his perfect rest in heaven. Do you see? It's not just that here at St. Helens we are telling people about Jesus, or that we at St. Helens happen to have found a few verses to say that you ought to be telling your friends about Jesus or introducing your friends to Jesus. It's his whole purpose. Right from the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 2, 1-3, we're told it's his purpose that he bring people from every nation to be part of his perfect rest in his new creation. It's not just a thing that we're into here. It is a thing that God is into. It's right at the heart of the very purpose of his making his world, that he should bring his people to his perfect rest. And I want to ask you whether it's right at the heart of your purpose. Does it govern your life? If it's God's purpose, if it governs his whole agenda, right the way through Scripture from start to finish, surely it should govern ours. You are a child of God's rest. Does it govern your work tomorrow morning? As you head into work tomorrow, does God's purpose govern the way you think, the way you live, the way you conduct yourself in every aspect? Are you concerned for those you work with, that they should enter his rest? God is. That's his primary concern. Are you taking action to introduce them to Jesus Christ? That's what God wants to see happen. Of course, he wants you to do your job well and effectively and all the rest of it. But that's his primary concern. Do you see how the purpose of God should govern every aspect of our life? What about where we live? Many people are happy to move house to get their kids into the right school. Often hear about people moving house in order to be in the right place for their hobbies and their personal comfort. I was talking to somebody this morning who's moving to India in order to introduce people to the rest of God. What about you? What about all of us? It'll affect what job we choose. If we've got Bible teaching gifts, we will, I assume, seek to put them at God's disposal, so that we can line ourselves up with his ultimate aim. It will affect the way we spend our time. If it's God's purpose that people enter his rest, then I guess we'll be leaping at opportunities like we were hearing to teach Bangladeshi children to speak in a Northern Ireland accent, or whatever it happens to be. To go out with the Oasis teams and work on the streets to introduce homeless people to the Lord Jesus Christ. I guess you'll be leaping at to come and teach the teenagers here at St. Helens on a Friday night. You see, it'll govern our time if that's God's purpose, won't it? Govern the way we choose to spend the money God has entrusted to us. If that's his purpose, well, we'll budget. We'll see how much we'll need, and we'll seek to put the rest of the money to the work of God, which is to bring his people from every nation to his place of rest. It's significant, isn't it, this three verses in Genesis 2? Well, now we've run out of time. As we close, let me ask you, have you thought about this major issue? Do you think you were just an accident? Do you think your number just came up in the Monte Carlo casino of life? Do you think you're just the beck and call of DNA that neither feels nor cares? Do you think that you're just a product of chance? Or do you believe in the living God? Because if we believe in the living God, he has a purpose. He has a purpose within this world. He has a purpose beyond this world. And his purpose is that people find rest in Jesus Christ from every nation, from every culture. And we need to make it our purpose and our aim. And then we will be living in God's world in the light of his concerns. Well, now, shall we sing? Where are we going to be sung to? Let's take some time to reflect on what we've been hearing. And Meg is going to sing to us. And then when she's finished singing, we will stand and join together in the song, My Jesus, My Saviour. But before we sing together, Meg is going to sing to us. And let's think about our lives and the direction of our lives in the light of God's purpose.